This is Free Speech Radio News for Thursday, April 25th, 2013. In Mountain View, California, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up, as President Obama visits the site in Texas to honor victims of last week's explosion, we'll look at the lack of government regulation at chemical plants and the heavy use of nitrogen fertilizer on U.S. farms. In Washington, senators advance a bill that strengthens online privacy protections. And we'll go to Iraq, where clashes among anti-government protesters and security forces have killed more than 100 in recent days. Those stories and more coming up.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for FSRN. Kurdish rebels announced today they will withdraw from Turkey next month as part of a peace initiative being negotiated with the central government. FSRN's Jacob Resnick has more from Istanbul.
Leaders of the Kurdistan Workers' Party have set May 8th as a date for a phased withdrawal from their bases in Turkey's Kandil Mountains that border Iraq. The 30-year conflict between the PKK and military has killed more than 45,000 people since ethnic Kurds, estimated to be about a fifth of Turkey's population, took up arms in an effort to gain language rights and political autonomy. Some Turkish nationalists are critical of the government's dealing directly with the PKK and have been demonstrating in cities across Turkey. A 23-year-old activist in central Istanbul is collecting petition signatures, protesting the government's dialogue with the PKK, which is listed by Turkey, the United States, and European Union as a terror organization. But there is also optimism here. Parliamentarian Altan Tan of the pro-Kurdish Peace and Democracy Party told FSRN that armed struggle is finished. Now he says lasting peace will depend on whether the government's commitments are sincere.
Türkiye'de demokratikleşecek, yeni bir anayasa yapacak.
Turkey is writing a new democratic constitution, which will guarantee Kurdish rights. But it's not certain that the prime minister will keep his promise to make a new democratic constitution that will fulfill the agreement.
The PKK has also warned the military to show restraint and said any fresh offensive against the group would scuttle the agreement to withdraw. Jacob Resnick, FSRN, Istanbul.
The death toll from yesterday's garment factory collapse in Bangladesh has risen to nearly 250. Some people have been rescued from the rubble, and the rescue efforts continue. Security officials tell international media that they ordered the evacuation of the building the day before the collapse because of structural issues, but managers of the factories operating inside did not heed the order. Protests continue today as garment workers from several areas of the capital, Dhaka, marched and clashed with police. Clothes for several international clothing and retail outlets were made in the factories of the collapsed building. The International Labor Rights Forum has confirmed Joe Fresh, Benetton, Kato Fashions, and Children's Place. The Children's Place website touts a supplier code of conduct, saying it only purchases from companies that, quote, will provide employees with a safe and healthy workplace in compliance with all applicable laws and regulations. The Security Council has authorized a United Nations mission in Mali. UN Radio's Deanne Penn has more.
On Thursday, council members unanimously voted in favor of establishing the United Nations Multidimensional Integrated Stabilization Mission in Mali, or MINUSMA. The 11,000-strong force will take over from African troops in the country, which has faced more than a year of crisis, including a military coup last March and an armed rebellion in the north. MINUSMA is set to deploy in July for an initial period of 12 months. Deanne Penn, United Nations.
In Russia, an organization has been found guilty of violating a new law requiring registration of NGOs who receive foreign support. The election monitoring group Golos is the first to be found guilty and fined. Organizers say the ruling may force them to close down. FSRN's Yekaterina Danilova reports.
A Moscow court has ordered Golos and its director to pay $13,000 in penalties. Golos refused to register as a foreign agent with the government after the group received $9,000 from the Norwegian Helsinki Committee for winning the 2012 Sakharov Freedom Award. The group says they refused the Norwegian money and sent it back. They also deny that their activity is political. Grigory Melkonyans is the deputy director of the association. He says the ruling creates a bad precedent for other NGOs.
Now, unfortunately, all non-governmental organizations to whom any foreign organization or citizen will transfer money are under threat. And the Ministry of Justice and Prosecutor's Office will say they're foreign agents, even if they've sent this money back.
In years past, Golos received a bulk of its funding from USAID. The group plans to appeal today's ruling to the Constitutional Court. The government has been expanding its investigations with NGOs that support people with disabilities and children with cystic fibrosis, the latest to come under scrutiny. Ekaterina Danilova, FSRN, Russia.
Emergency officials have allowed fires aboard two barges in Mobile, Alabama, to burn themselves out. Mobile Fire Rescue said the barges were carrying raw gasoline, fuel with no additives. Video posted on CNN shows two separate fireball explosions, but seven separate blasts have been reported, the final around 2 a.m. this morning. Emergency crews evacuated the surrounding areas. Three members of a cleaning crew on board were critically injured. This morning, a hazmat team determined the area was safe for investigators to enter. And finally, the Rhode Island Senate cleared a same-sex marriage bill on Wednesday. The House passed a similar bill earlier this year, but now it will have to approve the Senate amended legislation before it goes to the governor, who has indicated he will sign. Marriage equality legislation passed the Delaware House earlier this week. The Democrat-led Senate there is expected to approve it as well. And that's headlines for FSRN. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
I'm Dorian Marina in Mountain View, California. President Barack Obama and the First Lady are in Texas today to speak at a memorial service honoring more than a dozen people killed in a massive fertilizer plant explosion last week near the town of Waco. As survivors of the disaster begin to file lawsuits against the company responsible for the facility, some watchdogs are criticizing the lack of government regulation and oversight of this and other chemical factories, as well as the environmental consequences of U.S. farmers' pervasive use of nitrogen fertilizer. FSRN's Alice Olstein reports.
Authorities have still not identified a cause of the April 17th fire and explosion at the West Fertilizer Company, which killed at least 14 people, injured more than 200, and destroyed several nearby homes and businesses. But government records show the plant has been operating for decades with little oversight, leading to a number of serious violations. The Environmental Protection Agency fined the company in 2006 for not creating a risk management plan for spills, gas leaks, or explosions. The U.S. Pipeline and Hazardous Materials Safety Administration also cited them in 2010 for lacking proper ventilation and for poorly labeling the volatile chemicals stored in the building. But the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, the main agency tasked with inspecting such facilities, hasn't visited the West Fertilizer Factory since 1985. Keith Wrightson with the watchdog group Public Citizen says this plant's record is indicative of lax oversight at many U.S. factories, and the situation could get worse as automatic budget cuts take effect.
It has been 28 years since the facility received its last inspection, which is not uncommon for workplaces to go this length of time. The Occupational Safety and Health Administration, or OSHA, does not have a lot of resources. In the entire country, there are roughly 2,200 OSHA inspectors charged with inspecting every workplace across the nation.
This year's OSHA budget is about $583 million. And if Congress doesn't lift the sequester cuts triggered in March, it could lose $46 million of that funding. The White House estimates that this will lead to, quote, roughly 1,200 fewer inspections of the nation's most dangerous workplaces. The agency is also limited in how they can punish companies that break the rules. The West Texas plant paid a few thousand dollars each time it was cited, and in some cases bargained those fines down by promising to remedy the problem. Wrightson says this creates a climate where it's more profitable for companies to operate unsafely.
If they're only going to get a tiny fine or a slap on the wrist, there's really no incentive for the facility to clean up its act. As it stands today, the maximum fine for serious violation is $7,000. So if you kill somebody on the job, the maximum fine that company or that employer is going to receive is a $7,000 fine for that one infraction. Where's the accountability in that?
Wrightson said Congress could draft bills to increase these fines, which have remained the same since 1990, and mandate more frequent inspections. The agency did create a special program in 2011 to more closely regulate high-risk industries like chemical plants, but the West Texas plant didn't produce enough tons of fertilizer or have enough employees to qualify. This disaster highlights the risk factors in producing chemical fertilizer, which the U.S. uses in millions of tons per year, mainly to grow corn and other heavily subsidized commodity crops. But many environmentalists, including Don Carr with the Environmental Working Group, say there are other serious consequences to a dependence on chemical fertilizer.
These fertilizers run off into our streams and lakes, and they collect in water bodies, and algae feeds on the fertilizer. It blooms and it sucks all the oxygen out of that water, and it creates these massive sprawling dead zones, for example, in the Gulf of Mexico, where it's the size of New Jersey, and no life can live in it. If fish swim in it, they die.
Carr says as flooding and other extreme weather events become more frequent due to climate change, fertilizer contamination is likely to become more severe. The owner of the Texas plant, longtime local resident Donald Adair, promised that he and his employees will fully cooperate with federal investigators in the weeks ahead. He said in a statement, "We pledge to do everything we can to understand what happened to ensure nothing like this ever happens again in any community." Alice Olstein, Free Speech Radio News, Washington.
In Washington today, a Senate committee unanimously approved legislation to bolster online privacy protections by requiring law enforcement agencies to obtain a warrant before accessing personal emails and other electronic files. Progress on the Electronic Communications Privacy Act follows on the heels of newly released government documents that reveal close collaboration between the Pentagon, the Department of Homeland Security, and Internet service providers in monitoring communications carried on private networks. On Capitol Hill, FSRN's Anna Simonton has more.
Since Congress passed the Electronic Communications Privacy Act, or ECPA, in 1986, sweeping changes in communication technology have taken place. The Senate Judiciary Committee took the first steps towards modernizing key privacy provisions of the law Thursday, advancing a bill that would require a warrant in order for law enforcement officials to obtain private emails. Vermont Democrat and Committee Chair Patrick Leahy says Fourth Amendment rights, which protect against unreasonable search and seizure, should also apply to emails older than 180 days.
No question, if somebody wants to go into your house and go through your files and drawers, they're going to need a search warrant. But if you've got the same files on in the cloud, you ought to have the same sense of privacy.
Some members of the committee expressed concern that the protections would hamper law enforcement agencies from carrying out investigations efficiently, particularly in civil cases, such as fraud investigations, in which they can't get a criminal warrant. Utah Republican Mike Lee countered that the bill still allows officers to access certain content through subpoenas when a warrant is not an option. Digital privacy advocates, including Alan Butler with the Electronic Privacy Information Center, are praising the committee vote, but want to see further changes to ECPA.
There's been proposals about addressing the uncertainty surrounding location data, for example. Due to the prevalence of cell phones and other handheld devices that we carry with us every day, we're necessarily generating records of our location, and we need to address the privacy expectations that apply to those records.
As Congress debates how much access the government should have to citizens' online records and communications, information is surfacing about how much data federal agencies are already able to obtain. The Electronic Privacy Information Center received government documents through a Freedom of Information Act request this week, showing that the Pentagon, the Department of Homeland Security, and communications companies have been working together to intercept communications from private networks. The Pentagon started a program in 2011 to solely monitor communications within the military industry. President Obama authorized an extension of the program in February to cover all critical infrastructure, a term not clearly defined in the executive order. When some service providers expressed concern that handing over the personal data could be illegal, the Department of Justice granted them immunity for criminal violations of the Wiretap Act. The House of Representatives passed the Cyber Information Sharing and Protection Act last week, which would make it legal for companies to share information about specific users with the government. But the Senate Committee on Commerce, Science, and Transportation said Thursday that they will not take up the bill and instead plan to write their own legislation related to cybersecurity. Anna Simonton, FSRN, Washington, D.C.
This week, Green Party leaders Jill Stein and Sherry Hunkala launched a Green Shadow Cabinet to, quote, serve as an independent voice in U.S. politics. The initiative is modeled after shadow cabinets in other countries and is organized into six federal branches: democracy, economy, ecology, foreign affairs, general welfare, and justice. Ben Mansky, chief of staff for the shadow cabinet, told FSRN that the purpose is to bring together the voices and perspectives of those shut out from mainstream politics.
It's nearly 100 prominent scientists, educators, health practitioners, community leaders, labor leaders, students, people who are representative of the broad reach of American society, who are coming together to show that there is an alternative to the two-party system. And we will be responding to policies and actions coming out of Washington, D.C. in the months and years ahead.
The shadow cabinet will highlight environmental concerns like climate change and promoting the Green New Deal, as well as economic, labor, anti-war, and peace and justice issues. Mansky says a challenge to the status quo is needed.
When we see the collapse of economies in Europe and Latin America due to the policies of neoliberalism, and we don't hear any disagreement between the Obama administration and the Republicans in Congress on economic policy, you will hear and you will see that disagreement, that alternative view coming from the members of the Green Shadow Cabinet. When you see a war of empire expanding around the world unchecked, and again, a consensus between the Obama White House and the Republicans in Congress on the use of force to impose an economic policy that's hostile to the needs of the world's peoples, you will hear a differing view, another view coming from this alternative government, in essence, a shadow government, which is represented by the Green Shadow Cabinet.
Cabinet members include historian and political economist Gar Alperovitch as new economy advisor to the president, physician and single-payer advocate Margaret Flowers as Secretary of Health, and longtime human rights and grassroots organizer Ajay Mubaraka as public intervener for human rights. To find out more about the full Green Party shadow cabinet, go to our website, fsrn.org.
I'm Ralph Nader. Why do we need free speech radio news? With 200 reporters over six continents giving you the reality of the world and not taking any corporate money? The answer is in the question. If you really want to learn about what's going on in terms of the brutality around the world, the power of militarism and empire, how people are trying to preserve the planet from climate change to environmental improvement for farmers and consumers and workers, if you want to learn more about what people are really doing to fight back, people who are suffering but not giving up, you will listen to Free Speech Radio News. Free Speech Radio News cannot exist without your support. That's what makes it honest. The contact for your support, FSRN.org. Let's remember that, FSRN.org. They're waiting for your collaboration.
In Iraq today, Sunni and Shia leaders criticized government security forces for their response to anti-government protests earlier this week that led to scores of deaths. Clashes in Kirkuk killed more than 100 in the past several days after security forces broke up an anti-government protest in Hawija on Tuesday, which left more than 50 dead. Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki warned of a return to sectarian civil war in the country. The violence comes days after local elections restrictions in 12 provinces last weekend. For more, we're joined by Mohammed Al-Obaidi. He's a longtime resident in Baghdad and a shop owner there. First, Mr. Obaidi, protests have been going on for some time. In February, there were protests in Ramadi that drew thousands. The latest violence began Tuesday in Hawija. How are these protests different than what you've seen in Baghdad or what you've seen across the country in the past?
We had protests a couple of years back here in Baghdad and elsewhere. What I know of the Baghdad protests is that they've mainly been led by the educated elements of Baghdad, like artists, NGOs, even maybe some college teachers. And they're basically protesting against corruption and how corrupt the entire public sector was and how bad were the services. Some were demanding change of the regime, but again, based on corruption and unlike the current sit-in and protests in mainly Sunni provinces. These ones are mainly now led by tribal men and tribal leaders who are, you know, demanding equality between Sunnis and Shiis in this country, and are rejecting the oppression, the general oppression on the Sunnis, and mistreatment by security forces.
And some of the protests have highlighted the issue of detentions and torture by security forces as a reason for their protests. What about that?
Well, I mean, like I said, it starts with illegal arrests. If a security breach happens somewhere, say an explosion or assassination of some soldiers, they round up people by tens or hundreds, and they torture some of them. One of the outrageous acts they do is that they take hostages and arrest women instead of their husbands or their brothers, which is a great social taboo in our country, and in particular in countryside. This is intolerable, intolerable offense to their honor. And again, people have been held for years in prison, and since the time of the American occupation of Iraq until now, we have people spending years in prison without facing trial. And then you have many cases where people pay hundreds or a few thousands of dollars and get released from any charges they are faced with. And then you have cases where security forces arrest people and blackmail their families for money. I mean, we either charge you with this, or you know, you pay this. So they are dressed in uniform, but they're acting like gangsters. So how do you hope to stop that?
Well, today, Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki warned of a sectarian civil war returning to Iraq. There are some indications that violence could spread, according to the Christian Science Monitor. An al-Qaeda-linked group, the Islamic State of Iraq, appealed to Sunnis to arm themselves against the government, and Shia cleric Muqtada al-Sadr threatened to withdraw cabinet ministers from al-Maliki's government. How far could this go?
Well, a new civil war is a very possible reality. Sunnis are very fed up with the way they're treated, and the Shiis have a great mistrust in Sunnis. And with the current oppression and corruption that's going on, it's you know, things can develop. I mean, as a retaliation to the crushdown of the protesters in Hawija, Kirkuk, you had, you know, Sunni tribal men attacking police stations in nearby towns, and even in Mosul City up in, to the north. So, you know, it will be just like, you know, an avalanche. One event triggers another, and vengeance keep going, and you have a cycle of violence.
Mohammed Al-Obaidi is a shop owner in Baghdad, a longtime resident there. He spoke to us about the government's response to protests and deadly clashes this week in Iraq. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you very much, sir.
In the Gambia, the government has backed away from an announcement last week that it was banning cyber cafes from offering internet calling providers like Skype. Now the government says the ban only applies to the commercialization of voice over internet protocol services. But residents are still concerned about the move, as FSRN's Alpha Jallo reports.
In a completely deserted cyber cafe in Gambia's main business center of Serekunda, Musa Keita repairs some of his computers. As the cyber cafe operator, he says he's not happy about the government's announcement last week that said, and I quote, offering dating services and voice over internet protocol services as a commercially available service was unauthorized.
I think the move is very harsh, given the number of people who use these facilities to make cheap communication to their loved ones abroad. Many people come to our cyber cafes because of the availability of these facilities. If we are now asked not to provide these facilities, it's just like telling us, close your places and go out and beg.
Gambian officials said the ban is necessary because these calling services were taking away revenue from Gamtel, the state telecommunication company. But many residents say they depend on these inexpensive internet facilities to reach their families and loved ones who live in other cities and countries. Fatou Drame is a Senegalese woman who lives in the Gambia with her husband. She has no internet at home, so she goes to the cyber cafes to call her family in Senegal.
This ban is going to affect many of us. Phone calls are very expensive in this country, and many people relied on the cyber cafes to call their family and loved ones. I go to the cyber cafe every Saturday to call my mother and sisters in Dakar. Really, this ban is going to affect me because I cannot get money to buy phone cards.
While the ban would create difficulties for families, it also could help silent voices in the media. Many people use voice over internet protocol services to call into radio shows, including Freedom Radio and Hello Gambia, which are critical of the regime of President Yahya Jammeh. Ablaye Diakité is a Senegalese human rights activist.
In my own opinion, the main objectives for this ban on internet voice over protocols is to suppress the voices of Gambians. I think Gambians should be allowed to voice their concerns, and they can only do this through their internet facilities at a cheaper price.
In response to the ban, the Director General of the Public Utilities Regulatory Authority clarified his office statement. He said it is not meant to stop Gambians from using internet voice over protocols such as Skype and Viber, but that cyber cafes will not be allowed to commercialize them. Alpha Jallo, Free Speech Radio News, Dakar, Senegal.
That's it for today's program. The newscast was produced by Catherine Kopp. Headlines editor was Jess Burns. Our Washington, D.C. editor, Alice Olstein. Our technical production team at KPFA Berkeley is Jeanine Etter and Carla West. Our theme music was composed and produced for FSRN by Alan Weatherhead. We welcome your questions, comments, and news tips. Write to us, comments@fsrn.org. For more news story specials and our documentaries, visit our website, fsrn.org, and follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/FSRN. Thanks for listening. In Mountain View, California, I'm Dorian Marina.